We begin with these words from the Lebanese poet and mystic Cahil Gibran. There were two streams running in the heart of the Nazarene, the stream of the kinship to God, whom he called Father, and the stream of rapture, which he called the kingdom of the above world. And in my solitude, I thought of him, and I followed these two streams in his heart. Upon the banks of the one stream of his heart, I met my own soul. Sometimes my soul was a beggar and a wanderer, and sometimes it was a princess in her garden. Then I followed the other stream in his heart. And on my way, I met one who had been beaten and robbed of his gold, and he was smiling. And farther on, I saw the robber who had robbed him, and there were unshed tears upon his face. Then I heard the murmur of these two streams in my own heart, and I was gladdened. It is long since our cedar tree has fallen, but its fragrance endures, and will forever seek the four corners of the earth. Jesus has spent the past days drawing people to him, the handpicked 12 that would be his inner circle, these disciples that would become his apostles. He has also been traveling from place to place, cities and synagogues, homes and hilltops. He has been teaching and healing. And as he has traveled from place to place, the crowds have been growing, a great crowd, a diverse crowd from different places. Judea and Jerusalem, Tyre and Sidon have been drawn to him. Now, if I were to ask you to imagine the Beatitudes in your mind's eye, what would you see? Perhaps you see a bucolic scene of Jesus serenely sitting on a rock, hand raised in blessing, with the multitude sitting in humbled reverence at his feet, like a great king of the ages extolling wisdom and justice, with creation itself as his throne room. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It is a great scene to be sure, but one more suited to the more comfortable interpretation of the Beatitudes in Matthew's gospel. It is not what we see here in Luke's telling of the story. The scene is anything but serene. These Beatitudes are anything but comfortable. The people have traveled far from Judea, Jerusalem, Tyre, Sidon. They are tired, they are hungry, many of them are sick and scared. The scene is chaotic. The people are demanding. They press in on Jesus. They want to touch him and take the power they feel within him. Voices wailing, hands clutching, leprosy and lesions, hunger and hopelessness, unwashed faces and unclean spirits. Voices wailing, hands clutching, pulling Jesus down, down into them, down into their need, down into their fear, down into their desperation. As a person who doesn't like crowds at the best of time, never mind in pandemic times, my chest tightens just thinking about it. But that's what we see here. The needs of the crowd, the needs of the world are overwhelming and scary. This is not a Moses on the mountaintop moment with the light of God shining on his face, luminous and beautiful. This is dirty and desperate. Jesus is not elevated above the people. Jesus is down in and with the people, on a level place with the crowds, Luke says, in and with the messiness and vulnerability and uncertainty of human existence. And there, in and with the people, in and with their need, Jesus does something unexpected. You would think he would climb onto that rock and address the people directly, like a politician giving a stump speech, assuring them that he has a 5-point plan to lift them out of their lot in life. Cut the red tape, stop the gravy train, feel your pain. But that is not what Jesus does. He stays down in and with the people, in and with the crowds, and instead turns towards his hand-picked disciples, the disciples that would become the apostles that would form the enduring movement in his name. He turns and addresses what would become his church. Now, given the overheated state of our society right now with protests and counter-protests and how ground down we all are from the pandemic and how anxious we may be about what learning to live with COVID might mean, I admit that I wish our lectionary reading offered Matthew's interpretation of the Beatitudes today. The more lofty, pastoral, generalized, spiritualized version where we hear Jesus proclaim from his high place, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." That would be safer, that would be much more comfortable. But that's not what we have here today. We don't have Jesus being lofty, we have him being direct. Not particularly pastoral, but blatantly blunt. Not generalized, but specific. Not spiritualized, but very matter of fact. This is the stream of rapture which flows through the Nazarene's heart that demands choices to be made, real world choices, everyday choices. He has encountered the needs of the world. Voices wailing, hands clutching poverty, sickness, unwashed faces, unclean spirits. He has encountered the needs of the world, and he turns to the church and he says, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry, for you will be filled. Blessed are you who weep, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you, revile you, and defame you." And he also says, and this is where we should all start squirming in our seats, "Woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did to the false prophets." In one of the most direct and challenging teachings in the Gospels, Jesus encounters the needs of the world and demands those who would be his followers to look deeply at their lives and to make some very hard choices. Christ asks for, and indeed demands, our everything. The Methodist theologian Thomas Frank says, "These Beatitudes in Luke are not about our aspirations to godliness. They are about a community of disciples standing with the grieving, the poor, the hungry, as Jesus does. Luke asks us to follow Jesus into the crowd to learn from him, not from parsing his teachings for every word of higher law and eternal truth, but from working alongside him. For Jesus, the spiritual was bound up with the physical, and the physical embodied the spiritual. The two were intertwined like the roots of a tree. You cannot heal the spirit when the body is broken through grinding poverty and addiction and malnutrition. You cannot manifest the kingdom of the above world, as Gibran puts it, when some have more than they could ever use, while others don't even have the basics of life." What Jesus is doing here is turning to the church and asking, no, demanding, those of us with privilege to see how we have been blessed. Blessed by where we were born, blessed by systems of support, blessed by access to education and healthcare, to clean water and sanitization and opportunities for growth. Jesus demands that we not take our blessings for granted and to use whatever blessings we have been given for the blessing of the world. And if you can't do that, if you won't do that, then woe to you. Woe to you if you worship idols of prestige or power. Woe to you if you think that following him will bring you material prosperity. Woe to you if you are selfish or self-centered or greedy. Woe to you if you think your freedom is more important than someone else's health. Woe to you if you insist that you haven't benefited from privilege. If you were to drop a pin on the center of the opioid crisis in Toronto, you would land on the front lawn of Metropolitan Church. Each day we encounter those that the world has written off, the destitute and despised of our society. But if you cannot see that with a few different choices and a few different supports given or removed, they could be on the couch watching this service right now, and you could be out there in the cold with a needle in your arm. If you cannot see that, then woe to you. In one of the most direct and challenging teachings in the gospel, Jesus encounters the needs of the world and demands those who would be his followers to look deeply at their lives and make hard choices. Now, I don't believe that he demands that we give our resources to the point of destitution. The arc of his ministry is always towards healing and justice, and so we are not called to romanticize poverty or intentionally seek out suffering. But what he does demand is that no part of our lives, our blessings, our privileges, and especially our actions go unexamined. How we spend our money, how we spend our time, what we eat, with whom we eat, how we interact with creation, what we post on social media, how we treat those around us, especially those on the margins of society. To build the kingdom of the above world, Jesus demands that we make choices in the messiness and grittiness of this world, choices of compassionate empathy, generosity, and selflessness, choices that move us closer to God and to each other. To build the world we want and need, Jesus demands our everything. Living 6 centuries before Christ, the prophet Jeremiah stood in the midst of a time of transition. His career as a prophet began in the shadow of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem and ended in a time of exile, when he and many others lost their homes, when the holy city was conquered and destroyed by the Babylonians, they were forced to flee to Egypt. Exile was to be their new normal. The people of God had to make a choice. Would they cut themselves off from God and God's commandments and live like a stunted shrub in a parched and uninhabited salt land? Or would they hold fast to God and God's ways and be like trees planted next to flowing waters? Would they be like great trees with deep roots and green leaves and abundant fruit? What choice would they make? Be cut off or stick together? In his beautiful book, The Hidden Life of Trees, the German forest scientist Peter Wallaben describes the complex and interdependent relationships of trees in a forest. Over the course of their evolution, trees have developed sophisticated communication and cooperation systems. They have their own version of consciousness and wisdom. Each tree has its own personality and can feel pain. Each tree is forced to make decisions about its life, decisions when to shed its leaves and which direction to grow its roots in. When trees make mistakes, they learn and don't often make them again. Although it may seem like trees aren't loners, indeed the opposite is true. They are intimately connected to each other through underground networks of roots and fungi, and are deeply dependent on the life of the community for their growth and for their survival. Just like us, when they are in trouble or in pain or in need, trees cry out for help. When a tree struggles to obtain enough energy or moisture or is under attack from insects, other trees will often send help in the form of their own nutrients. Trees seem to understand very well, perhaps even better than humans, that supporting the whole community, the whole forest, is in their own best interests. Each tree relies on its immediate neighbor, as well as the whole forest ecosystem for its very survival. Individuals in a community are protected and can live long and robust lives. They can thrive even in the most challenging of circumstances. In contrast, solitary trees like street kids in the park, cut off from systems of support, often die much younger. Trees know that it is simply better to be together in supportive community. The great tree, the great cedar tree of Jesus' earthly life, fell in the Holy Land long ago. But who he was, what he said, what he did, and the spirit and mission he left continues to provide nourishment and support and meaning for those who continue in his name. The crucified one, the living Christ, continues to encounter the world's need. He continues to demand that we who would be his followers look deeply at our lives and to make hard decisions about how the blessings we have received may be a blessing to everyone around us. To build the kingdom of the above world, Jesus demands that we make choices in this world, choices of compassion and empathy, generosity and selflessness. To build the world we want and need, he demands our everything. Like tree roots under the forest floor, there is no space between me and you, them and us. The salvation of one is entirely dependent on the salvation of the whole. Life is better by living it together. This church has its roots in Methodism. And so we end now with this call from its founder, John Wesley. Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, for as long as you can. May it be so.